Hey everybody, welcome back to Cold Case Murder Mysteries. I'm your host Ryan Krause, coming at you once again to explore yet another fascinating unsolved homicide. In this episode, we're taking a look at the horrific and untimely deaths of 10-year-old Blake Dickus and his 26-year-old stepmother, China, who were attacked at home on the afternoon of July 24, 2019, in Franklin, Indiana. Now, what makes this such an interesting case is that the killings have a very personal feel to them, yet there has never been a solid suspect in the case, allowing it to go cold over the years. However, it's difficult to forget the brutality of something like this, so let's see what we can do to add some clarity as it pertains to unmasking the assailant. Now, what really irks me about these killings, aside from two innocent people being slaughtered, of course, is that the police have released very little information to the public regarding the circumstances surrounding the crime, especially as it pertains to the crime scene. We don't know where the bodies were found inside the home, or even if they were together. On top of that, there's no description of the crime scene, nor do we have access to any photos. So, the idea behind that is to allow the investigators to vet suspects as they arise by withholding pertinent information only the killer would know, and also to prevent the true assailant from learning what evidence the cops do have on hand. It's a good strategy, but not 13 years after the fact. As of 2015, there were supposedly still 5 detectives actively working this case, so I'm assuming it hasn't gone completely cold in their eyes. But the reality is, whatever they're doing isn't quite working. That's not a criticism, just an observation that suggests change is key. At some point, the VDOC Society got involved at the request of the police, yet that has only seemingly benefited the case to an extent that the police followed their advice of releasing a bit more information to the public. That happened, but in all honesty, it's not enough. They're banking on keeping the scene inside the home secretive, for the most part. So, let's quickly summarize the events and then dive into the evidence. It's the afternoon of July 24th, 2016, in Franklin, Indiana, at the Brannigan Woods subdivision, a collection of suburban homes that seem to be geared toward people with middle-class lifestyles. The development is still under construction at the time, but it's inhabited by a lot of new residents. The people in question, the Dickus family, just moved in about a month prior to the murders. Sean Dickus, 33, lived there with his wife of 3 years, China, who was 26. He was previously married to a woman named Christina, who was Blake's mother, but they got divorced. Now, I really don't know what precipitated that divorce, nor is it clear what type of agreement Christina and Sean had regarding custody of Blake. He's at his dad's house on a weekday and planning to go back to mom's place after a week visit, so it sounds like this might have been some type of split custody agreement rather than just weekend visitations with dad. It's really difficult to say, but it does seem like Blake had strong relationships with both his mom and dad, as well as his stepmom China. So on that day, Sean goes to work in his truck and is gone from the house until lunchtime. At some point later in the morning, getting closer to lunch, China calls Christina and asks if Blake can stay for lunch because his dad is coming home to eat with them on his break. Christina says sure, that will be fine. She bought tickets for them to see a movie, which Blake was apparently really excited about, but that wasn't until later in the day, closer to the evening, so Blake staying at dad's for a while longer was no problem. China says she'll drop him off later at his grandmother's house, where Christina plans to meet him to head to the movie theater. So, Sean Dickus arrives home at 12:45 p.m. in his truck to have lunch with China and Blake. They eat and hang out, with Sean leaving around 1:45 p.m. to go back to work. When he leaves, he says he gives Blake a kiss goodbye, gets in his truck, and then pulls out of the driveway. According to Sean, China is outside at the mailbox at this time. He gives her a kiss as well, and then proceeds to go back to work. Later that day, Christina goes to her mother's house to pick up Blake for the movie, and he's not there. China never dropped him off. So she's thrown off by this, and calls China, but gets no answer. Of course, she also calls Sean, and gets no answer or any reply from him at all. At this point, she's mad because she allowed Blake to stay for lunch, accommodating Sean and China, who seemingly haven't shown her the same respect in return. So, she drives to their house to get Blake. Meanwhile, Sean arrives home from his work shift at 5:14 p.m., and when he pulls into the garage, he notices the door leading from the kitchen to the garage is open. This isn't odd, according to him, as China would sometimes come out and wait there for him when she saw him pull into the driveway. So he doesn't think much of it. But that's when he goes into the house. Again, with most crimes, we're going to get details about the scene and also photographic evidence to accompany it. But not here. The cops have kept a lid on that, except to say that there was blood all over the house. Whatever visuals the scene may have rendered, a horrified Sean Dickus calls 911 immediately to report the incident. Soon enough, the police arrived to learn China Dickus was brutally stabbed to death, and Blake suffered the misfortune of being bludgeoned, smothered, and stabbed. Needless to say, this is not something any father or husband wants to see upon arriving home from work to meet his family, nor is it something Christina is prepared to deal with when she arrives. Christina turns her vehicle onto the street and immediately sees a swarm of blue and red flashing lights. The police are everywhere. She parks and approaches the home, only to see yellow caution tape surrounding the perimeter of the driveway. Christina ignores it, making her way toward the garage, where she's stopped by a cop who wants to know who she is. She remarks that she's Blake's mother and demands to know where he is. The man is unable to even respond immediately, and Christina realizes something is wrong. Blake's been hurt. But being in shock, she tries to downplay what the result might be. She wants to know where they took Blake. She asks which hospital he's in. And the cop realizes that she isn't going to accept the truth until he says it explicitly. So he tells her that Blake and China are dead, bringing her world to a crashing halt. Yet, in the 13 years since, we still haven't identified the killer, or even a motive. Since most people are killed by somebody they know, the easiest thing for me to do first is eliminate anyone close to these people who could have potentially had problems with them. Now, as often happens, there can be animosity between divorced couples, or even between the new spouses and/or significant others of a person's ex. Of course, we don't have that dynamic here. With both Blake and China being murdered, it's fairly obvious there was no revenge being perpetrated on Christina's part. Had China and Sean been killed, we'd certainly look at that possibility, but the fact that the new wife and Christina's son were killed negates the potential for that type of plot arising. There's nothing to gain by it. Now, there are no valuables missing from the home. We don't know what, if anything, was taken, but the police say they still do not have a motive. Of course, that means robbery is off the table. It still could have been a home invasion, but nothing substantial, in terms of material items, was removed from the house. Again, most people are killed by somebody they know, but certainly not everybody. And I think the key here is determining if this crime was an inside job or if it was the work of a stranger. While anything is possible, this case essentially puts a fork in the road that suggests the truth is at the culmination of one, while the other is nothing more than a dead end. So, we need to determine which is the fool's gold. The first possibility is Sean Dickus. The other is a connection to local burglaries. So let's talk about those break-ins. This event happened on July 24th. Starting the month prior, in June, the area surrounding the home, specifically within a half-mile radius, was burglarized 5 times, according to the police. In each of these occurrences, at least one intruder entered the homes by way of cutting a screen on a ground-floor window in a T-shape. After seeing at least one of these cuts, it's apparent to me that something like a box cutter was used for the task. The cuts are precise and clean. We don't see rips or tears that are uneven or jagged. They were made with one horizontal slice on top of a vertical slice that runs perpendicular to it. In each case, the criminal entered homes when they were unoccupied and did so during the day when the homeowners were away at work. So, This is an interesting choice, but I think it has a lot to do with the area being under construction at the time. According to reports, three separate home builders were operating within Brannigan Woods at the time, including what would have equated to dozens of contractors. So, that's a lot of total employees. Needless to say, there was no shortage of people present at any one time. There were homes neighboring the Diggis residence that were being worked on, even though they were already living in their new house next door. Of course, large construction sites often draw the attention of vagrants for various reasons. I had a summer job back in the day, working labor in one of those subdivisions, and we would occasionally find somebody homeless sleeping in the unfinished properties, or they would wander in during the day for various reasons. But this is different. This person is entering finished, occupied homes. Now, again, the break-ins began just prior to the Diggis family moving in, sometime in June 2006. All five had the same manner of entry by cutting a first-floor window screen, and all occurred during daylight hours when the homeowners were away. More interesting, though, is the behavior of this person within the homes. We can't say it was only one person, but all indications are that it's the most likely possibility based upon what the police could gather at the scenes. Inside these homes, police found behavior consistent with a sociopath seeking emotional dominance over his victim's peace of mind, rather than one who's simply running a criminal enterprise, stealing valuables for the purpose of profit. In fact, nothing of substantial value is taken from any of the homes. The police described the actions as light ransacking, specifically that the homes weren't being torn apart and left a mess, but the perpetrator would leave a few drawers or cabinets open here and there. He took things like souvenir coins, food, drinks, a pitcher, and other little knickknacks. Nothing valuable. So, this isn't about profit. And that means this is a bad situation. It's really scary. And the burglar knows that. Because it's a message. Here are a couple of people who did these types of things to assert psychological dominance. One is a 14-year-old boy named Josh Phillips, who's currently serving a life sentence for killing 8-year-old Maddie Clifton and stuffing her corpse under his bed back in 1998. The other is Joseph James DeAngelo, the Golden State Killer, who very well might be the most prolific, terrifying criminal in American history. It's about control. If you come home to find your jewelry, TVs, phones, tablets, and the rest of your valuables missing, it sends a very clear message. You got cleaned out. It's terrible, but what it says is that they wanted to steal your shit, and they aren't coming back anytime soon because you no longer have anything to offer them. That's a criminal enterprise, no matter how low rent it might be. It's for profit. But if someone comes in your house, eats your food, goes through your personal stuff, and simply takes a few little knickknacks, it's a whole different ballgame. This type of behavior is about dominance. It says, I can come in here whenever I want, do whatever I want, and you can't stop me. It leaves the homeowner wondering who would take such a big risk for such little gain. That's the point. Psychological dominance. If you can't identify a specific reason they showed up in the first place, you don't know if they're coming back. If all your jewelry and other valuables are gone, it's clear what they wanted. But if somebody takes nothing of value and eats your food while going through your drawers, it speaks to psychological control. This is indicative of a sociopathic criminal who's likely very dangerous. They're invading your privacy. It's intimate. In these situations, you have to ask yourself 100 questions that you won't be able to answer, such as, who did this? Are they coming back? What do they want from me? Why didn't they take my valuables? Is this personal? Do I know them? Maybe it's revenge. Am I being targeted or set up? How will I sleep at night knowing this? Am I safe? Are my children safe? Should I buy an alarm system? Or should I even react? Is it worth it to call the police on somebody for taking a souvenir coin and some food? Is it me he really wants? Am I being stalked? And the list of considerations goes on. You just don't know why somebody would do something like this. So let's take a look at the two criminals I just mentioned who did similar things, meaning Josh Phillips and Joseph James DeAngelo. Josh, at 14 years old, was breaking into his neighbor's homes by popping out ground floor window screens and subsequently doing strange things like carrying their nail gun around the home and shooting nails into random things. It was disturbing to the victims and seemingly pointless. But in these situations, you have to profile the behavior to understand why. So, on that note, what we learn about Josh Phillips is that his father ruled the home with an iron fist. He was excessively abusive toward the 14-year-old, both physically and emotionally, on top of establishing very strict rules in the household. So, when we examine his break-ins, what we can see is that the element he was looking for was control. Josh had no autonomy whatsoever at home. He was treated like a prisoner and walked on eggshells in fear all the time. So, by breaking into the homes of others, and very simply doing whatever the hell he wanted in their houses, absent of their approval or input, Josh finally felt what it was like to be in control at home. Nobody was there to tell him what to do. If he wanted to walk around firing nails into random places, he could do that without suffering consequences. He didn't steal their jewelry or their TV. He asserted psychological domination over his victims. That's the point. He was unable to control anything within his own home and sought to transcend that notion emotionally without the physical ability to escape. He was 14 and had nowhere to go to escape his suffering. So he went to the neighbor's house alone and asserted the physical dominance over their home that his father had over him, in addition to saddling others with the psychological torment of uncertainty he was made to endure. These break-ins were the physical manifestation of Josh's emotional issue. This is how he coped. Yet, what he couldn't see in the process is that such behavior leads to the abused becoming the abuser to attain power. He doesn't know any other way to succeed. So, that's basically a fast-track degree program to becoming a certified sociopath. It's fairly obvious what comes next after trying to dominate somebody's home. Like his father going after him, he's going to take his anger out on another child. The abused becomes the abuser. So what does he do to Maddie? He strangles her with a cord, hits her in the head with a baseball bat, which is basically just a block of wood given a specific shape, and stabs her with a knife until she's dead. And how does Blake Dickus die? He's smothered with something the cops haven't identified publicly, bludgeoned with a 2x4, and stabbed with a knife. It's essentially the same death Maddie receives. China Dickus is not bludgeoned or smothered. She's stabbed to death. So, there's a methodical difference at play. The children in both of these cases were killed in a very similar manner, and each death occurred in the aftermath of local home break-ins with the same MO left by the perpetrator. Josh Phillips wasn't interested in valuables. Nor was this person. So, if Josh committed the crime for emotional reasons, this person likely did too. While getting stabbed to death is obviously an up-close and personal, terrifying way to go, there's an element to Blake's death that seems even more personal than China's. There has to be a reason the method is different, and it likely relates to something emotional. So let's quickly look at why Josh killed Maddie. Now, the reason he said he did it doesn't have to match the emotional truth offered. It just has to reveal the truth in the subtext of his actions. So, Josh first strangled Maddie, not only as a means of killing her, but to keep her quiet. When the strangulation only subdued her, but didn't render a fatality, he bludgeoned her with the bat, hoping that would do the job. But soon after, he learned she was still alive, and that's when he finished the job by stabbing her with a knife. But we have to ask this. What element drove the sequence of actions? Well, Josh was afraid that his dad was going to come home and hear Maddie. He strangled the little girl to keep her quiet as she died. But it wasn't enough, so he bludgeoned her. That wasn't enough either, so he stabbed her with a knife. Gruesome stuff, especially when it involves a child. But what we can ascertain from the circumstance is that the reason Josh carried out the killing like that is fear. First, he tried to quietly kill Maddie by denying her air through strangulation, preventing his dad from hearing her when he came home because there would be consequences for sure. Then he uses a method that requires hitting her in the head, intended to not only kill her, but to knock her unconscious as fast as possible because she's still making noise after being strangled. Finally, once she's quiet enough from enduring the previous methods, he finishes by stabbing her. But throughout this nightmare scenario, Josh claims he felt a singular emotion. Fear. He was afraid somebody else in the house was going to hear Maddie's cries. So, if Blake dies in a quite similar fashion, we could reasonably assume the emotional disposition of the perpetrator is similar. He fears Blake being heard by someone else in the house because he knows the consequences will be terrible. Now, in the Clifton case, the real perpetrator, Josh Phillips, went unsuspected for a short time due to an interesting circumstance. His neighbor was questioned by police as a suspect, and that man failed a polygraph in relation to the murder, even though he was entirely innocent. This guy had no involvement whatsoever. So is it possible that, in this case, something similar happens that prevents the police from getting an honest read on who the killer might be? Well, since Sean Dickus was the last person to see his wife and son alive, he's given a polygraph. He passes, and the cops are thereby satisfied he has no involvement in the crime. But here's where we start to get to the part about how my crazy brain works. I really couldn't care less if he passed a lie detector test. I'm not suggesting he's guilty, but I have drawn the conclusion, after observing him, that those results shouldn't exclude him as a suspect. Now, before I break this down, let's examine what I consider the intersection of the two possibilities I'm offering regarding suspects. About those burglaries in the local area I mentioned, again, there were five. It seems like they started in June, right before the Dickus family moved into their new home, and extended into July, but those incidents stopped with the murder. Not only that, but the last break-in in 2006, utilizing that T-shaped cut on the ground floor window screen, in addition to the MO of that specific criminal, was the same day as the murder. That's right. On July 24th, somebody broke into a home only 200 yards from the Dickus residence and stole a couple of souvenir coins, ate their food, and removed a drink pitcher from the refrigerator. Of course, that proximity to the Dickus home makes this an interesting occurrence. Could it have been this guy? Well, it would help to know when the burglary actually occurred. Much like Sean Dickus not discovering the murders until 5:14 p.m., the same goes for the couple's home that got burglarized that day. So, when did this burglary occur? It wouldn't seem reasonable to commit a double murder and then burglarize a neighbor's house for petty things like food, drinks, and a pitcher that you could undoubtedly also find at the Dickus residence. So the police actually get a nice break here. The people who got burglarized soon realized something very odd. There was a camera on a computer desk at their house, and it appears someone took a photo with it inside the home. The timestamp suggests it happened at exactly noon, the same day Blake and China were killed. So if this person was in that home at noon, he would have only been 200 yards away from the Dickus residence at the time. Sean came home for lunch at 12:45 p.m., just 45 minutes after that photo was snapped. By 1:45 p.m., Sean has gone back to work. Now, I'm not sure if that's his usual lunchtime, but he stated that he frequently came home for lunch because he worked so close to the development. So, it's possible the burglar knew Sean's routine. On that day, Sean even says that when he left to return to work, China was out at the mailbox and he gave her a kiss goodbye. If anyone had seen that occurrence, it would be a pretty safe assumption that the kiss goodbye meant they'd be apart for a significant period of time that day. I mean, if he's just running to the store to grab milk and return, he's probably not going to stop his truck by the mailbox to give a kiss goodbye. Now, like I said earlier, I once worked as a laborer in a subdivision under construction, one in which some of the homes were recently occupied and others were still in the various stages of construction. At lunchtime, workers sort of go off and do their own thing. I would normally grab lunch from the road coach with a few of the other laborers, and we'd find a house where we could eat without being bothered by the boss or any of the other contractors present. It was one of those jobs where we'd report to the boss in the morning, and he'd give us a list of things we needed to do. But he wasn't supervising us all day, nor was anybody else. As general laborers, we worked for the builder and not any of the subcontractors on site. So the contractors never paid much attention to what we were doing. On occasion, they'd ask for our help if they were doing something like raising a second floor wall on a newly framed home, but otherwise, they mostly ignored us. All of which is to say, we were sort of invisible. Our boss ran the show there. He had too many problems on a daily basis to care about what we were doing. As long as nobody complained about us, we flew under the radar. There were times we left the site, and others when we would hide in a house somewhere if it was really hot out and we didn't want to do physical work. So, it would be reasonable to suggest, especially back in 2006 when we weren't documenting every second of every day, that a similar type of employee, such as a laborer, could go unaccounted for during the workday, especially at lunch. The easiest time to do it, again, without a doubt, is during lunchtime. So, in this case, we have an audacious burglar making his way into people's homes only during daylight hours, Monday through Friday, and specifically when people are away at work. Even more specifically, we know at least one of these break-ins occurs around noon, according to the timestamp on the camera. In addition, we know the person is also consuming food and drink while in these homes. Now, while the psychology of the person breaking into the homes dictates that he's seeking emotional control or dominance by helping himself to whatever he wants in the absence of permission, making the homeowner paranoid about his intentions, the practical value at play is that he might very well be hungry and thirsty because it's lunchtime. And if you belong in the neighborhood, meaning construction workers and residents alike are familiar with your face, you don't look out of place wandering around at that time of day between people's houses. Not only are you supposed to be there, but you don't need a vehicle nearby to come and go while committing the break-ins. You might have driven to work in the morning to get to the location, like everybody else, but once there, you wouldn't need to drive around and park. You could walk. And it wouldn't take much to not look suspicious. If you had a tool in one hand, or some debris you were looking to throw out, that would suffice. I mean, you could even carry something, like a 2x4, that was about to be used in a murder, and no one would bat an eyelash. Of course, you'd also be likely to have easy access to something like a box cutter that could cut a window screen, and even if you were holding it right out in the open, nobody would think you had ulterior motives. If you think about it, it's a little strange that this person was able to commit 5 burglaries in broad daylight in an area that was crawling with people during the day. In all honesty, if you picked another neighborhood to burglarize, one that wasn't under construction, your chances of being seen are minimal in comparison. There are enough moving parts at a construction site, in terms of people making deliveries, operating machines, viewing new homes, doing inspections, and myriad other activities, that not being seen, or noticed, is really quite odd. What's far more likely is that you would be observed by others. It's daylight. You have to go to and from these homes, and you're doing it even after the first few burglaries have been performed and subsequently reported to the police. So, without question, this type of crime would be much more feasible if committed by someone who was hiding in plain sight, so to speak, like one of the workers. According to the police working this case, it's quite rare for a burglary to occur within such a close proximity of a murder on the same day, and at nearly the same time. So, it does seem reasonable, and perhaps even likely, that the person who burglarized the home 200 yards away from the Dickus house is the same one who committed the murders of China and Blake. A big question for me is the timing. The police haven't told us exactly when they believe the mother and stepson were killed. If committed by somebody other than Sean, we know it had to occur between the time he left, 1:45 p.m., and the time he returned home at 5:14 p.m. Given the fact that he called the police immediately, there's no reason to believe the emergency medical personnel arriving on the scene wouldn't be able to offer a legitimate estimate of the time the deaths occurred. That 3-hour window doesn't leave enough time for evidence to degrade in any way. The blood is fresh, as are the wounds, and that leads me to believe the crime scene offered a timetable. Now, we, as the public, aren't privileged to that knowledge, but given the fact that the cops ruled out Sean due to an alibi, but still gave him a polygraph, suggests the murders likely occurred shortly after he went back to work after lunch, leaving open the possibility they happened while he was still there. For instance, if they were killed at, let's say, 4:45 p.m., and Sean has an alibi, the blood evidence should render the notion that it was so freshly spilled it couldn't have happened prior to 1:45 p.m. when he was still home. But the cops give him the polygraph. So while we can't know, I think our best guess is that Blake and China were killed at a time closer to when Sean left, rather than closer to when he returned. So, what I think might have happened here is that the person was a worker at the construction site and committed the burglary 200 yards away from the Dickus residence around noon during his lunch break. Upon returning to work from that incident, he likely noticed China out at the mailbox and Sean leaving in his truck. Now, of course, there was no forced entry involved, so he would have to get into the house somehow. If you're a worker at the site, this isn't difficult. When I was working as a laborer back in the day, there were often times when we had to check on something at a newly occupied home at the request of our boss, and did so without notice to the homeowner. We would just go knocking at the person's door, and most often, the type of person who would be home during the day was a young mother with at least one child. That's what we have in this murder case. Now, these women would generally just let us inside without any questions beyond what we needed to accomplish. It's quite common for newly finished homes to have problems, and if they're the type we're talking about, meaning the mass-produced suburban dwellings picked out of the builder's catalog, these problems often apply to all the houses being built. None of them are custom-made, so they tend to use the same materials and labor, leading to the same types of problems. Of course, what really sticks out to me in this situation is something like what you get in the Jennifer Kesey case. We know she had mentioned, and even complained, about the laborers at the construction site where she lived catcalling her and staring when she walked by. Soon enough, she got kidnapped and murdered. Or at least, we assume she did, because her body was never found. She was abducted from the condo complex where she lived, one which she specifically chose because the homes were new and she got a good deal due to the fact the surrounding area was still very much under construction. Jennifer was abducted in daylight hours, around the time others would be going to work as well. But nobody noticed anyone strange lurking in the immediate area. And, as Jennifer's car had been used to abduct her, that person clearly didn't come or go by way of his own vehicle that would be spotted and considered out of place. But hours after this happens, Jennifer's car is dropped off by a man at a location right down the road from her home. Why on earth would he risk returning to the scene, or at least driving the car back that way, to get so close to the crime scene? The most likely answer, of course, is that he worked at the construction site and had to return. So let me give you an insight that's a little creepy, but allows a better understanding of the mindset present in these situations. Construction sites are overwhelmingly comprised of male workers. Women also work in this field, of course, but for the most part, it's saturated with men, which produces an interesting dynamic. I mean, if you work in an office, and a group of men whistled and catcalled as you walked past, you could just go straight to HR and complain. So, harassment in that type of workplace is normally, but not always, on a one-to-one basis. It's kept quiet. However, when a group of men whistles at someone who doesn't even work for the company, it's difficult to complain and have them all fired for it. At most, they'll be told it's unacceptable and it has to stop. Now, that's not to say this is a regular occurrence at construction sites, but here's something that arises from that type of behavior, or even just from the company being comprised of men. Like I said, I can remember being a laborer at this site I mentioned, and a new family moved in while the place was still mostly under construction. Their home was finished, but there was still a full staff of workers on hand building other houses. It just happened to be a husband and wife with two young children, maybe ages 3 and 5, that sort of thing. The parents were an attractive couple, and workers around the site began to comment regularly to each other about how hot the woman was. In reality, she was pretty, but didn't possess jaw-dropping looks by any means. Yet, I watched her legend grow over a short time, perhaps only a week or two, and soon enough, guys were talking about her like they were totally obsessed. And it occurred to me that the construction site was like its own little world, cordoned off from the rest of society until it was finished and fully inhabitable. And in that world, at that time, she was queen. It didn't matter that anyone outside of the confines of the construction site could easily see that she wasn't worthy of this goddess status just based upon her looks. But at work, within the context of this creepy world of heterosexual men that gathered at the site every day, she was the most attractive woman around and was thereby the focus of idolatry and fantasy. You'd have some random guy walk up to you, ask if you've seen the lady living in so-and-so, at which point he'd tell you what he'd like to do to her sexually. I'd sincerely love to say that isn't true, but it is. There's a bona fide reason the most stereotyped group accused of catcalling, from reality to the movies, is construction workers. When you isolate heterosexual men in situations involving very few women, the perceived sexual value of those women escalates dramatically. The rarity of the target in question makes her more desirable. The reason is that, if everybody wants her, and you get her, you're the alpha male. We're hardwired to have greater desire for someone like that, because dominating her means your evolutionary value increases proportionately to the ratio of men to women at the construction site, rather than what it is in society. And I think that dynamic is exactly what got Jennifer Kessie kidnapped and killed. The number of residents at her complex at the time was lacking due to so many units remaining unfinished, and that led to such a strong sexual focus being placed upon her every day as she came and went. She complained to multiple people about this, about how creepy it was, and I know firsthand how it starts. Of course, most men, as crude as they can be, are just messing around. They have no criminal intentions in mind. Right or wrong, it's part of the game in certain workplaces that are heavily dominated by men. Unfortunately, with so many men around, you might just end up with one who isn't joking. He truly is obsessed. While you're telling the guy next to you, as a joke, what you'd like to do to her, someone's mind is actually churning with evil thoughts about really doing it. And of course, since it's just a fantasy, it's a situation that, if brought into reality, would have to involve crime. You can't just knock on a woman's door and expect her to capitulate to your sexual desires for the asking. Kidnap, rape, murder. That's a normal sequence of events for violent sex crimes. Strippers are notoriously at risk for being stalked or attacked, and people believe it's due to the sexual nature of their work. It's not. It's their perceived value. Strip clubs are packed full of men. Like the construction site, there are only a few women inside this isolated world of its own, and a lot of men who would like to be with them. When you see a large group of men staring and talking about what they'd like to do to this woman, it makes her more desirable to other men. It's a competition born of our survival instincts. Your brain can't discern the difference between being stranded on a deserted island with 300 other men and 4 women, or being isolated at a construction site or strip club that offers the same ratio. All your little male brain cares about is survival. If the women are few and far between, in any situation, it just makes them more desirable by launching a competition for their attention. It's drawing you into a game of trying to be the alpha male to ensure survival of the human species through the strongest genetics. If I were to objectify this pursuit, it would be the equivalent of hunting for gold or diamonds. The value is in their scarcity or rarity and not based in anything related to practical use. That mindset is exactly what produced the tradition of a man asking for a woman's hand in marriage through the process of an engagement ring centered with a diamond. He's speaking to her rarity and scarcity by offering a valuable metaphor of what she is. We all know, and from a practical standpoint, that foregoing that diamond engagement ring is a much better option for couples who are getting married and need that money for other things. But we'll go into debt before even considering taking that route. The value we seek in the transaction is evolutionary ascension and not frugality. So, in my opinion, there's a very good chance we have the presence of a guilty construction worker in this case. 26-year-old China Dickus might have been the target. Yet, we don't have confirmation from the police that she was sexually assaulted, or even that something went wrong during the process of a sexual assault, leaving the man feeling as though he was forced to just kill her instead. Had it been a sex crime perpetrated by a stranger, the police would have DNA from the subject and would have been able to rule out her husband. They didn't. Sean was given a polygraph. He agreed and passed. But let's examine him. The first thing that sprung into my mind when hearing about this case is the question of why Sean and Christina got a divorce in the first place. Even before reading about the crime itself, my brain was like, you need to find out why they got divorced. And my instinct is that these people have vastly different emotional dispositions, which turned out to be true, even if I still don't know why they divorced. Christina is highly emotional and displays a very genuine physical presentation in regard to her loss. She is clearly devastated, prone to crying even years afterward. Sean, on the other hand, is cold as ice. He doesn't show his cards. Not one bit. When I look deeper into his eyes, down into his soul, I still don't see any emotion. So what that tells me is twofold. Part of it says he was emotionally incompatible with Christina, something she was okay with when she was younger, but grew to realize wasn't going to work over the long term. China seems like she was a similar person, but younger, and perhaps like Christina at that age, didn't mind. But watching Christina talk about the incident, you feel so badly for her. Her emotional output is clearly authentic. But Dad is a different story. I just don't see it. At all. So the other part of that twofold consideration, for me, is that Sean is somebody I believe would be capable of beating a polygraph test. His alibi covers the hours between the time he left to go back to work after lunch and the time he left work for the day at the end of his shift. He admits he was at the home for 1 hour on the afternoon of July 24th to have lunch with China and Blake. If they're never seen again, that's awfully suspicious. The police claim to have cleared Sean based upon the alibi and passing a polygraph. Obviously, the police have access to information we don't. But I haven't come across anything from them that asserts another person was definitively proven to have been in the house that day. I haven't heard anything about DNA, fingerprints, hair evidence, the perpetrator's blood, or anything of that sort. In 2018, the police said they sent items from the crime scene to be retested with up-to-date technology, and clearly nothing arose from that endeavor that would warrant mention in the news, even though they did ask once again for tips from the public. That tells me what they have essentially amounts to nothing. I could be wrong, but I believe the reason they're protecting details about the crime scene to an extent it seems unreasonable is because they have nothing else. I think what likely happened in 2018 is they retested items for which nothing was found in 2006 in terms of physical evidence, and they were hoping to maybe find anything at all this time around with improved methods, but failed. Just try to picture this gruesome crime transpiring with the assailant not leaving any DNA whatsoever in the house. It's difficult to believe. Unless, of course, you live there and your DNA would be expected to be on both of the victims that day. Now, again, think back to what I said about the manner in which Maddie Clifton was killed and why, and let's place that into the context of what happens here. China is stabbed to death. We don't know where, nor do we know if the weapon came from the house or outside of it. We do know that a block of wood, in the form of a 2x4, was utilized in the crime, as it was found with blood on it. With Blake being the one who was bludgeoned, obviously the 2x4 was used on him. Beyond that, we're told Blake was smothered, yet we don't know what was used for that purpose. Combined with our ignorance about the location of the bodies, we don't have much to examine. So how do we try to recreate the actual crime? Well, our only option is to explore the psychology of the types of murder weapons utilized and do so in relation to the number of victims and the aspects of the circumstance we can assume are correct based upon the result. Let's try that in the context of an intruder being the perpetrator and also Sean. It's going to raise some very interesting questions. So, we don't know if Blake and China were together at the time of the murders. Or do we? If you consider Blake was not only bludgeoned and stabbed, but also smothered, what does that say? Well, look at the Maddie Clifton case. Why did Josh Phillips strangle her with a cord before hitting her with the baseball bat or stabbing her? The answer is that he needed to keep her quiet because he didn't want anyone in the house to hear her, leading to him getting caught in the act. Now, transfer that idea to the fate of Blake Dickus. Like Maddie Clifton, he's just a little kid. As a grown man armed with a knife and a 2x4, you should be able to take him out pretty easily. He might yell or scream, but he won't last long at all. Smothering a kid is the least efficient and least effective way to kill him, unless, of course, like Josh Phillips killing Maddie Clifton, you have to silence him first. So why would the killer need to silence Blake, but not China? Let's look at that. He can't attack them both at the same time and hope to succeed. Someone would make it to a phone or out the door. They could even yell out a window. And if he attacks one with the other watching, even if he told the second person to stay put, they're going to run to get help. The police have not mentioned anybody being tied up, bound, or restrained in any manner. So here's what that information tells me. It says Blake was smothered to keep him quiet, just like Maddie Clifton was. The killer didn't want to be heard. So if he was worried about being heard, who would hear him? In the Maddie Clifton case, Josh was worried his father might hear from another part of the house. Now, who would that be in this circumstance? Well, it's China, of course. And China is not smothered or bludgeoned. She is only stabbed. So what appears to have likely happened is that the assailant smothered Blake until he was unable to react audibly or was even unconscious, and then beat and stabbed him to finish the job. The 2x4 wasn't used on China, so I'd suggest the following. Blake was likely knocked out with a sudden strike from the 2x4, at which point he was either rendered unconscious or close to it. At that point, he was smothered until he appeared to no longer be breathing, but was still alive, at which point he was stabbed and perhaps hit with the 2x4 again. So, Blake was likely killed first and in a different part of the house than China. The police said there was blood all over the home, which indicates the killer did a lot of walking back and forth. But what we know for sure is that the smothering tells us he was afraid Blake would be heard by somebody. To the contrary, China being stabbed repeatedly in the absence of bludgeoning or smothering suggests the killer was not afraid of anybody hearing the event, even people outside. Of course, it was July. The AC was running, and the windows were shut. Now, there's no sign of forced entry, so if this was the work of a construction employee, he was left alone in a manner that allowed him to sneak up on Blake and hurt him in a way that kept him quiet. Possible? Yes, but if we consider the intruder might not have been a construction worker who weaseled his way into the home under false pretenses, then it means he got in another way. But there's no forced entry, and once he's inside, clearly China doesn't know he's in there while he's on the prowl trying to locate Blake. These things are all possible, but I have to say what I think is most likely, whether true or not. The fact of the matter is that Sean Dickus is the person who could most easily navigate a crime scene of this sort. If his son is playing video games in a bedroom while China is downstairs, he can walk right past China and even tell her that's where he's going because she has no reason to believe malice is involved. He doesn't need to control them or even just one person. Sean is free to move about the house without suspicion. That is, as long as he isn't heard hurting anyone. If Blake screams, yells, or cries from another room, China is going to react, whether it's an unseen stranger with Blake, or even if she knows he's with his dad. So what we see here, like the Clifton case, is that the killer is afraid that someone else in the house might hear the boy. Now, if you're there to sexually assault the young woman, then offing the kid first makes sense. But we don't have any reason to believe there was a sexual assault. And that's a problem, because if there's not, the husband is often the murderer. An intruder entering the home and killing the boy prior to the young woman would indicate a sexual assault to follow most of the time. When the Golden State Killer, who was also the Visalia ransacker, stepped up his game from burglaries involving ransacking to entering homes for the purpose of sexual assault, he ended up doing something very much like what we see here in this case. But he failed. The incident blew up in his face, and for one very specific reason. He didn't keep the girl quiet when he entered the home. Unlike Maddie Clifton getting strangled, or Blake getting smothered, to keep others ignorant, Joseph James D'Angelo simply held the girl at gunpoint and kidnapped her. He assumed scaring her would be enough. But what happened is that, while he was dragging her out of the house, she not only fought against him, but the noise woke her father. The dad came outside, and Joe, who couldn't shoot the girl because that's who he wanted to rape, was forced to let her go in order to kill her father as he closed in on the kidnapper. So, Claude Snelling died, but saved his daughter in the process. The big mistake Joe made was believing he could keep her quiet due to fear of him and the gun, instead of ensuring that she would be quiet by knocking her out, gagging her, or doing something similar. But what I think is really important to understand is why the plot failed. Obviously, and as proven by the result, Joe knew he was an unknown intruder. So if he went in there with a gun and something went wrong, he would be able to use the gun and his athleticism to escape. The worst case scenario happened, and he still got away with it for decades. But here, in this case, we're talking about broad daylight. So, if you're a construction worker from nearby, and in daylight, you can't flee the scene to wherever and get away with it. If you're missing from the job site right after a double murder, and it's daytime, not only could you have been witnessed by multiple people, but other people will realize that you disappeared from the job and didn't return. The point is a burglar from the construction site, in addition to Sean Dickus, would be the two parties most likely to require the victims not being heard. It goes double for Sean. If he did this, there's no way for him to get away with it if the kid isn't silenced right from the start. Joe D'Angelo, on the other hand, doesn't act with such fear because he can shoot his way out if something goes wrong. He's an unknown assailant, and it's the middle of the night. So the thing he didn't have to worry about when entering a home with one child and one adult involved in the incident is being identified if something went wrong. They wouldn't even have a clue who he was if they saw his face because he's a stranger. On the other hand, a local construction worker might very well construe himself as someone who would be recognized by neighbors because he's been around so much. They might not have conversed with him, but they've seen his face and know he works there. If you're Sean Dickus, that scenario is even more legitimate. Everybody is going to know who you are. So it's pretty clear to me that Blake is smothered due to fear on the part of the perpetrator, and specifically in relation to the other person in the house, China, hearing what's going on and foiling the plot. And that's why I've used the Maddie Clifton case as an example. When Josh strangles Maddie to keep her quiet due to fear, we have to ask this. Where was he? The answer is in his own house. And what was he afraid of? He was terrified that another family member would hear what he was doing. When Joe D'Angelo failed to do this, where was he? Inside a stranger's home. So what we have here is a strong suggestion that the smothering of Blake Dickus was imposed on the boy by somebody he knew and out of fear that someone in the house, who also knew the perpetrator, might hear his loud cries for help and react. And if that person was smothered out of fear someone else would hear it, then that means the other person in the house, in this case China, knew and accepted that the assailant was in the home, but had no reason to fear what they might do. The two possibilities in that case are a construction worker from the site showing up unannounced and under false pretenses, or that person in question was Sean Dickus. Nobody else would have been able to move freely throughout the home without causing suspicion. In the absence of forced entry, the person entered by traditional means. So, yes, it could have been an unlocked door, but we don't know that. So, on that note, let's talk more about Sean coming and going from the home. Blake was supposed to go home to his mom's house that day, and do so prior to his dad coming home for lunch. That means Blake should have been gone already when the murders occurred, but something, or more appropriately, someone, decided he should stay. And then he gets murdered. It could be a coincidence, but let's examine how that would happen. Either China would have to come up with the last-minute idea that Blake should stay, or it was Sean who made that choice. Either way, China is the one who calls and asks Christina if it's okay. Not once in any interview I've watched or in any article I've read has anybody mentioned that it was China's idea for the boy to stay. If the purpose she stated on the phone to Christina was for Blake to be able to have lunch with his dad, then I'm leaning toward Dad being the one who wanted that to happen. We don't know that, but we do know that China isn't around to tell us the story, and Christina wouldn't know whose idea it was if China called her for permission. What I can say is this. Blake talks to his mom, Christina, only a half hour before getting the follow-up call from China, and says he can't wait to go to the movies. He asks mom if they can stop and get candy on the way, to which she says yes. So this call that happens between Blake and Christina occurs at the Dickus residence. So not only is China aware of it and how excited Blake is, but she also already knows she's the one who's supposed to drop him off at his grandmom's house in just a little while. So if she knows that, why doesn't she ask Christina at that time if Blake can stay for lunch? Why does she call back in a half hour to ask that question? In my eyes, the most likely reason is that she wasn't thinking about it at the time. If it was her idea, however, she would have been cognizant of the necessity to ask permission during the first phone call. I mean, Blake is literally on the phone with his mom, confirming that he's going to get dropped off by China at the previously agreed upon time. Clearly, China didn't have the thought of Blake staying for lunch at that point, even though Christina was on the phone with him confirming the pickup time that involved China dropping him off. It would be difficult to overlook something like that. The way Christina tells this story doesn't assert that China wanted Blake to stay for lunch. She simply asks if it would be okay for Blake to stay. Given this call to Christina is last minute and happens only 30 minutes after a call in which Blake confirmed when he was getting dropped off, my intuition says Sean was the one who wanted Blake to stay for lunch, and he had China make that request at the last minute for him by way of the phone. Sean never tells us China made that decision, not in any of his interviews. Neither do the police, nor does his ex-wife Christina. I think if the cops checked Sean's call log from work or his cell, we'd learn that he made a call to China before her second call to Christina in order to ask her to call Christina and make the lunch request. The point is that somebody made a last-minute change to Blake's plans, and we don't have reason to believe it was China's idea because she didn't mention it in the first call, which was only a half hour earlier. His mom, with a face full of tears in an interview, says, quote, "I didn't think anything would be wrong with it, him having lunch with his dad," end quote. And I agree. While possible, it's really odd that he gets murdered as a result of that choice. In fact, based on the timeline, it gets China killed as well. Do those things happen? Yes. Does this feel like an organic situation to me? No. Allow me to elaborate. Not only do we have no explanation as to why the lunch was changed at the last minute to include Blake, or who made that decision, but when Sean leaves the house, meaning when he pulls out of the garage in his truck, he offers the revelation that China had just walked out to the mailbox. He says he gives her a kiss goodbye, just like he did Blake, and then drives away. It's interesting that he places China outside the home, meaning alive, at that time. If we look at the logistics, it definitely makes sense he would give Blake a kiss before he left, if the kid was, in fact, not yet grossed out by old dad kissing him at age 10, because Blake was about to go back to mom's house after spending a week with Sean in China. But like I said earlier, he's only planning to be away from China for the rest of his shift at work and the ride home, which equates to 3 hours and 29 minutes. That's not such a long period of time it requires another formal goodbye. And if we look at the layout of the exterior of the house, it's clear that when Sean pulled out of the garage to the end of the driveway, he'd have been on the driver's side of the truck while the mailbox was a significant distance off to the right. He simply says that he gave China a kiss and left. He doesn't say he stopped and spoke with her, but the reality is that she'd have to walk back to the truck and then around it to give him a kiss, regardless of which way he went when pulling out. So, this interaction would be a little lengthier and more complex than the way he offers it, but he just says he gave China a kiss. That certainly doesn't prove anything one way or the other, but I absolutely do not like the mysterious last-minute change to lunch on the last day of Blake's visit, resulting in him getting murdered. Of course, that's just my intuition screaming that something isn't right, in the same way I feel about China being at the mailbox as a means of establishing her being alive when Sean went back to work. His actions, or lack of elaboration upon why and how these things transpired, along with the absence of emotion in his presentation, have me just a bit curious. Now, again, I have to largely speculate in the absence of more info on those points, so please take them with a grain of salt. Sean deserves that. But what he also deserves is the ass kicking I'm about to serve up right now, one that is based wholly in fact. It's astonishing to me that nobody covering this case even mentions this shit, but here it goes. Sean drives home from work and enters the home to find Blake and China dead under some truly awful circumstances, so he calls 911 for help. That's the right thing to do, of course. But guess what he doesn't do afterward? He doesn't call Christina, or anybody else for that matter. He leaves her in the dark. Not just for a few minutes, but completely. She learns of her son's murder by way of arriving at the home, totally ignorant, and being informed by a cop. Of course, the cop has no idea who she is and stops her attempt to try to approach the crime scene because no one has bothered to bring her into consideration. It's his mother. Now, if you're Sean, and you know Blake was supposed to get picked up at his grandmother's house, but clearly didn't make it, it's obvious Christina is going to be clueless as to what's going on. And that's how you decide to let her find out? She has to drive around, first angry while thinking China and Sean just blew her off and didn't bring her son home when she had plans with him to go to the movies, and then to just happen upon all the police cars and caution tape outside the residence? Can you even imagine how horrifying and confusing that was for her to experience that without warning? Her dread while approaching that cop must have been overwhelming. I can only imagine the panic she was enduring. And Sean, Mr. Emotionless, obviously couldn't give a fuck about her feelings. I mean, it's just downright cruel. If you discover this scene, the first thing you do is call 911. That goes without saying. The next thing you do, which is what everybody does, is call your loved ones who were closest to the person in question and would be most affected, meaning, generally, immediate family. When I once found somebody dead upon arriving home, the first thing I did was call 911. As soon as I hung up with them, I immediately called my father because he had the most significant relationship with the person who was deceased. Even though they were separated and hadn't been together for a couple of years, they'd known each other for decades and had two kids during their marriage. There was no way in hell I was going to just call 911 and let my dad come home later to find the street crawling with cop cars and caution tape. That's ridiculous. It was difficult to tell him she was gone, but it was unquestionably the right thing to do, and was also a very natural reaction. I told him she had passed, and said the cops are outside the door about to knock, so can you please let everyone else know, because I have to deal with what's going on here. I'm not even a very considerate person compared to most, and that was still my immediate concern. It's called sympathy. I knew the hurt that I felt being surprised by that awful sight, and didn't want anyone else to have to suffer the burden of coming home to that. But in this case, Sean never tries to call his ex-wife, nor does he call her mother, even though Grandmom's house is where Blake was supposed to get dropped off that day. Sean calls 911, but does not give a fuck about his dead son's mother. That's the first person I would call after getting off the phone with 911. If 911 kept me on the line until the police arrived and they said they needed to speak to me right then and there, I would request that they have any one of the cops comprising the swarm outside the house to do so. But not only does Christina get left out of the loop, they aren't even expecting her when she arrives. They don't know who she is. For a man who doesn't cry or show any other type of emotion, instead displaying a calm, soft-spoken demeanor at all times, I find it difficult to believe he would avoid calling his son's mother to let her know the bad news. Her relationship to Blake, as one of two parents, is equally significant to his. He wouldn't forget her. So if he didn't forget her, but also didn't call, and furthermore, didn't request the cops let her know, then it says she was avoided. Sean even says in his interviews that Blake talked about how excited he was to go to the movies with his mom later that day. He knew she'd be driving all over town trying to find out what happened. Now, let me tell you what this looks like. I think this might have been a result of Sean's plan going awry due to a miscommunication between Christina and her mother. When Blake didn't show up at the time he was supposed to get dropped off, Grandmom let Christina know he hadn't arrived yet. But Christina, having just talked to China when the lunch plans changed, had so recently gotten confirmation of her bringing Blake home that she disregarded that message as though China was probably just running late. She'd just talked to her a while ago and had no reason to believe anything was wrong. So she just assumed, after not hearing from her mother again after the first message, that Blake was dropped off at some point afterward. So she gets to her mom's house to realize Blake was never dropped off. It's not just a case of China being late. So she calls China and obviously gets no answer, and then calls Sean, gets no answer, and never gets a reply from him, leading her to drive over to Sean's house. Now, let's examine that same situation in the hypothetical context of there being no miscommunication. Christina gets the message from her mom that Blake didn't arrive. Thinking China's just running late, she follows up with a call to China, which goes unanswered. She calls her mom back to see if anything has changed since their first call, thinking China might just be on the road and not answering. After that, as Christina actually did, she formulates the opinion they might be blowing her off. So she drives to the house and knocks. Nobody answers. Sean comes home from work. Upon doing so, he opens the garage door to pull in, at which point they realize China's vehicle is inside. So it seems like she's home, and nobody is answering the phone, so it now seems like something is wrong. Sean and Christina enter the house and discover what happened to China and Blake. That's likely how that situation would transpire. But here's what's important to notice regardless. Whether Sean ignores Christina, as he actually did, or assists her, as he did in the hypothetical situation that would have transpired organically, he doesn't have to tell her that her son is dead or even explain what happened. In both cases, either by chance or willfully, he negates having to relay the message, her son is dead. Even if you put a spin on the hypothetical situation in which Christina overreacts and calls the police rather than meeting Sean first, Sean still doesn't have to tell her. All of these scenarios lead to Sean not telling Christina what happened to her son. And if it isn't organic to avoid telling her, then the path to getting there likely wasn't either. It strikes me in the same way as the last-minute lunch change. Sean said he had no idea about the local burglaries until after the fact, and the police believe, based upon how things were left inside the Dickus home, that the scene was consistent enough with those break-ins to have been perpetrated by the same person. And while the burglaries stopped after the murders, specifically on that day, they actually started again the next summer, taking place during June and July 2007 as well. It almost seems like somebody worked a summer job at the construction site and disappeared for a while, only to return the next year. I'm sure this person, guilty of murder or not, realized the cops would be looking at him as a suspect. So, I think the burglaries would have stopped regardless of whether or not that person was the killer. So, this is definitely a difficult case to examine, especially in light of the fact the police don't offer details about the crime scene. The scene could have been staged to make it appear as though the burglar was guilty or not. We just don't know. But what we do know is that Blake's grandmom, meaning Christina's mother, not only called China several times on the afternoon of the murder when she failed to arrive with Blake, but also called Sean repeatedly. So did Christina. Yet, Sean didn't answer, nor did he return those calls once he got out of work. You'd think he'd be concerned, knowing his son was supposed to get dropped off at Grandmom's house earlier. But just like Sean does to Christina, he avoids contact with her mom, Carol. It's a bit convenient, and suspicious as hell if you ask me. Sean displays an obvious lack of empathy and sympathy failing to show concern and emotion at times he absolutely should. So, while I think this case is a coin toss, and the murders could easily be the work of an intruder, I believe the profile of this killer more strongly matches Sean Dickus. The murders are not indicative of psychological control. They were brutal and seemingly not consistent with domination, sexual assault, or anything related. There might have been items rearranged in the home to make the scene appear as though the neighborhood burglar is guilty, but his method of entry isn't the same, nor is the use of violence or even entering a home that was occupied. All of those considerations betray his MO at the time. Yes, people graduate to more serious crimes, but this one seems a huge leap from even what he did a couple hours earlier in the day. It isn't a burglary or home invasion gone wrong. The 2x4 was obviously brought in from the outside and left at the scene. Of all the things he could have left, it's something that points to the construction site, which of course suggests someone came in from the outside to kill them. When Sean Dickus got home that night at 5:14 p.m. and opened the garage door to pull in, he saw the door to the kitchen was wide open. What he's suggesting is that the killer left through the garage. Really? Whether it's electric or not, it is, without a doubt, the one door on the home guaranteed to make the most noise opening and closing. And if he didn't shut the door from the garage leading into the kitchen, why would he shut the outer garage door? It would be noisy as hell. Now, you could argue he went into the garage to find items that were valuable that he could take, but that's not his MO. That's not what this burglar was doing. If there's no sign of forced entry, nobody broke in. That betrays the notion of this specific burglar, unless it's someone from the construction site who manipulated his way into the house. If I have to choose between the likelihood of someone like that committing this crime, or Sean Dickus, I have to lean toward the man who lives there. I think it's possible he heard about the burglaries and used that opportunity to build an alibi around his work schedule. We don't specifically know that he left his home at 1:45 p.m. to go back to work. We know he got back to work in a manner that would suggest that's possible. He could have killed China and Blake in the first 5 or 10 minutes of being home, and subsequently disposed of his bloody clothing and other items that can be construed as evidence before going back to work at the time he was expected. There's no way to confirm he was actually at home for the full hour he claimed. So my guess, and I could be wrong, is that the police don't have physical evidence related to an intruder. I believe they're weighing Sean's alibi and polygraph success against whatever evidence they have that he's guilty, and from a legal standpoint, it's a dead end. However, Sean's unwillingness to answer or make phone calls, in addition to his inability to realize there's a problem prior to getting home, is totally inexplicable. He was called repeatedly. He did not return those calls. That not only seems intentional, but consistent with exhibiting guilt. He avoided both Carol and Christina in situations where intuition says anybody else would have bothered to wonder what the problem was. When you have young kids and are in the process of switching custody after a visit, you should care. It's obvious. Sean didn't. No emotion, no empathy, no sympathy, and no response. He avoided contact. For that reason, I'm leaning just a bit in his direction when it comes right down to it. The intruder theory, given the break-ins in the neighborhood, of course, is also a good fit. But I think this is a case of choosing the devil you know or the one you don't. With that considered, I believe Sean offers more of a reason to be suspicious. If the intruder came from outside and was the guy who broke into the house nearby that same day, he must have had a change of clothes on hand in case he wanted to murder someone and walk off in broad daylight. But nobody sees him. There are a lot of people who believe there was a sexual assault in this case, and that the police have DNA, but are withholding that information as leverage for later. Let's consider that idea. If the perpetrator committed a sexual assault, he already knows they have his DNA. There's no reason to withhold that information. It's rumored that the bodies were discovered near each other, almost as though one murder couldn't have been committed without the other person knowing. So, what transpired there? Simple. If you're Sean, and you've just killed Blake with actions that begin with smothering and bludgeoning to keep him quiet before finally stabbing him, you'll have blood all over yourself. If you go back to kill the other person, and she sees you upon approach, and does so with enough time to flee, she's going to do that. You'll be approaching with a weapon, covered in blood. But if you're Sean, and you can call out to China to make her come to you, in the absence of suspicion, because you just killed Blake in a manner she couldn't hear, all you have to do is say something like, "Hey, can you come in here for a minute?" Or, "I need a hand for a second." Or, "I need your opinion on something." Or, "Look at this cool thing Blake made on the computer." That's all it would take. When she complies, in the absence of suspicion, you can do anything from jumping out of a closet to hiding behind a door to sneaking up on her. Now, there's a post on Reddit that seemed to get a lot of attention, one in which a person claims to have been living next door to the Dickus family at the time. She says the killer got the 2x4 from behind the wheel of a camper at her brother's house when she was staying there, and that he tried to open her front door. She looked outside at the time, but didn't see anything, and therefore thought nothing of it. Apparently, the killer then went to the house next door, the Dickus residence, and found the front door unlocked. He entered, went upstairs, and discovered China putting away clothes in a dresser. He attacked her like a wild man, slashing and stabbing her repeatedly, leaving blood all over the room. She ran out of the master bedroom, likely calling out to Blake, who was in his bedroom, to flee and call the police. According to this account, which was supposedly relayed by a detective with whom this person's brother was friendly, when Sean arrived home, he discovered Blake right inside the doorway of the front door, with the door opened partially and with a bloody handprint belonging to Blake on it, as though he was about to escape per China's instructions. China, on the other hand, is supposedly found at the bottom of the stairs, and it's totally gruesome. She's been cut open so that some of her organs have spilled out onto the floor from the upstairs hallway going down the stairwell. Not only was she stabbed, but she was also sexually assaulted in a very violent manner with a broomstick. Really interesting. Is that true? I don't know. The police certainly have not acknowledged it as truth. But the thing that's missing from that narrative, for me, is the smothering aspect. If the killer chases China out of the bedroom, onto the stairs, and she's the first one attacked, how does Blake get past them upon exiting his bedroom? He would have to pass somebody armed with a knife and a 2x4 in a very cramped space like a stairwell while China is fighting for her life in front of him. The knife would be going all over the place. It would be nearly impossible to get through that space. Plus, China is never hit with the 2x4. It seems odd that he had it the whole time he was attacking China, and then only proceeded to use it on Blake. But the smothering, again, is what gets me. If Blake was running for the door, the killer would have to chase immediately. He only has two hands, and so is only armed with the knife and 2x4. If he wanted to smother Blake, he'd have to find something with which to do it. And what's the point? If he's about to escape, you have to beat him to death right then and there to stop it from happening. I mean, you could suggest there were two killers, but the shoe prints found at the scene would have made that clear since there was blood everywhere involving a struggle. On top of that, this person writing this post claims the police had evidence of Sean's involvement, but didn't do anything about it because murders don't usually happen in that area. Yet, the rest of her post staunchly supports an intruder theory. For me, it's very likely bullshit, or comprised of some truth and some bullshit. I have no doubt certain elements could have been garnered from the police, but that story goes so far as to say the killer removed Blake's fingernails. We don't know that. This person also claims that Sean Dickus drove past her on the road while she was out running an errand at lunchtime, and when she got home nearly 20 minutes later, she saw him pulling out of the driveway. Of course, there's no mention of China being present at the mailbox or even next to his truck giving him a kiss. So, again, while there might be elements of the truth embedded in that tale, none of it has been verified by law enforcement. And that brings us to the end of the line. We have so little info available from the police that we're forced to speculate. If I had to choose between the killer being connected to the burglaries or the assailant being Sean Dickus, while it is a coin flip, I have to think Sean is probably guilty. As stated previously, I think his unwillingness to communicate with both Carol and Christina that afternoon, along with the failure to call Christina after the discovery, or even have someone else do it, speaks volumes to his intentions and mindset. The child's mother should have been at the forefront of his mind. She wasn't. He should have intuitively realized that a series of phone calls from the parties who were supposed to receive custody of Blake that day indicated something was wrong. But he didn't act. He didn't return the calls, not even after getting off work. Carol was ignored. Christina was ignored. And he failed to show any emotion in the aftermath. When speaking about his young wife who got butchered, we get no tears. When speaking about his young son, we also get no discernible emotional reaction. But there is a single line in all of his interviews where his voice cracks. No tears, but there's just a little bit of humanity shining through the clouds hovering over this man. Like I said, it's not about his wife or his child. Guess who it's about? Him. He nearly chokes up with the line, which is, quote, "I was a great man," end quote. For whom is that remorse? There is not even a trace of either of the victims in that line. It's all about him. He chokes up when he says, "I was a great man." Needless to say, he went on to stay in that house because it didn't bother him. Again, I'm not pointing the finger. He very likely could be innocent. Yet, his behavior says he's not. He never talks about what the victims might have gone through. He never speculates about their suffering. Meanwhile, Christina, face full of tears, wonders if her boy cried out for her, and thinks of the horrible things they did to him. She can barely live with the thought of it, and says her life has been frozen in time ever since the moment she heard. Sean, on the other hand, gives us nothing. He tells us he was a great man when he had China, but he never speaks of her awful suffering. So maybe he has regrets about something. As it stands, we might never know. I lean toward Sean as the killer, but if it was announced tomorrow that the burglar was the guilty party, I would not be shocked in any way at that result. The police simply don't give us enough evidence to choose wisely. And with that, the answer to who killed Blake in China remains a mystery. So, when I thought about how I'd like to close out this episode, and what all of this means, something spoke to me, by way of intuition, and I felt obligated to listen. I got this strong feeling, almost like a silent whisper in my ear, something realized rather than heard. It asked me to pose a single question about that day of the murders. And that's this. What movie were Blake and his mom, Christina, supposed to see the night he was killed? The one he was so excited about that she even bought the tickets beforehand. My brain said to me, "You know why I want you to look, don't you?" And I replied, "Yes, I understand. I know where this is going, and I believe the truth will be revealed." So, I check, and it turns out the movie they were supposed to see was Superman Returns. That franchise died a horrible death in 1987 with Superman 4, but suddenly rose from the ashes to be a viable product again with Superman Returns. Ironically, Kevin Spacey plays the bad guy, Lex Luthor. But what's really fascinating about Superman, which ties into everything I talk about on this show regarding the future, is that he has dual identities. One is that of Clark Kent, a decent human being, but one who is unremarkable and seemingly incapable of amazing feats. The other is Superman, of course, who is superhuman, or, more accurately, a superhero, bestowed with the gifts of incredible physical strength and impervious skin that humans don't have. So what happens is that every time humanity is in trouble, and their survival is at risk, in a situation where evil is raining down upon them, threatening to destroy their city, or even the entirety of civilization, along with planet Earth, Clark Kent utilizes the autonomy of his ability to become a superhero in the blink of an eye, and quickly changes into Superman. As he switches from human form to that of a superhero, he's then able to save the day before going back to being Clark Kent once again, retaining his secret. But the idea is that Clark Kent has superpowers even when he's Clark Kent. The purpose of changing into the superhero costume is that he's driven to keep his secret due to fears about how humanity will react to the fact he's not really one of them. He wants to be accepted, to not be a freak, to be considered part of the crowd. He's a genetically enhanced superhero, but society isn't ready for him yet. So he hides among them as a man and comes to the rescue as needed to save them. Yet, in his own mind, he's never quite able to reconcile the fact he's a superhero against the expectations of humanity. He simply wants to be one of them. Normal. He even tries to relinquish his powers, but soon realizes he can no longer save humanity because he's regressive technology. He becomes one of them, and they hate him for it. Meanwhile, he realizes being untrue to himself means he's no longer special. They wonder where Superman is, and he becomes the subject of their scorn. Until he returns. But when he does, he has the same problem of needing to hide from who he really is. Clark Kent is a lie. Superman is the truth. As Clark Kent, he can't help save the world. As Superman, he can always do it. But his dilemma is that he wants to be Superman, yet also be just like everybody else. Society isn't ready for that, however, so he has to desperately hide the truth. And what that truth equates to is a metaphor that says the world needs Superman to save it from the evil the humans perpetrate upon one another, and the path to getting there is through societal acceptance of genetically enhanced humans who are, in essence, technologically superior to the ones currently present on Earth. Clark Kent, of course, has the same desires as Superman. He wants to save the world, but he can't. Only the superior, genetically enhanced, technologically advanced version of Clark Kent, as Superman, is able to accommodate the need. Yet, Clark has to keep the secret because he doesn't want to be construed as a freak. it brings him a great deal of unhappiness. And again, when he tries to regress to accommodate social norms, he loses that thing that makes him special. The point is that the world needs superheroes and simultaneously rejects extraction of humanity to accomplish the goal. Superman has to show up to save them from themselves again and again, but they won't accept him as normal in society. He has to remain a superhero. It's about social rejection related to the normalization of genetically enhanced or machine-like humans who defy mortal considerations. Clark wants to be a superhero and also be like everybody else, but he can't come out of the closet, so to speak, or, more accurately, the phone booth, because he just wants to be like everybody else. He knows that can't happen as things stand in society. So the point of Superman is that his emotional wound of being this immortal freak who has to hide from society overshadows the fact that, even with these modifications to his humanity that allow him to save them from destroying themselves, he still can't just blend into the crowd and be appreciated. So he fights this by trying again and again to achieve his goal through the unremarkable Clark Kent, a normal everyman, and keeps failing. The authentic identity he needs to engage is Superman, but the world isn't ready to accept him as one of them. And the brilliance in that is that it's a total hypocrisy. He's a freak, unlike them in their eyes, but they're more than happy to accept his help and cheer him on when the world is on the verge of being destroyed due to human greed and arrogance. What it says, at a base level of projection, is that we all need to normalize being superheroes in order to save the world from the destructive forces of humanity. Society needs them, and also needs them to be created from people who are otherwise unremarkable. Yet, what's even more important is to realize that the extraction of human qualities involved in making superheroes lends itself perfectly to upholding the virtues of civility, kindness, caring, and selflessness, not destroying them. The genetically enhanced being, through his superpowers, is able to do more for the world, to change things the inferior humans are incapable of accommodating. But in that process, what we learn is that Superman is no less human due to what he is. He struggles with his identity, of what he was born into, but can't reconcile. If we look into his past, we find he comes from the planet Krypton, a place that was obliterated just after his father Jor-El sent him to Earth. On Earth, he has superpowers, but if he comes into contact with kryptonite that remains in space from the aftermath of the destruction of his home planet, he becomes mortal. He left his home planet because it was about to become uninhabitable and became an immortal superhero in the process. The only thing that can make him mortal again is coming in contact with kryptonite, which symbolizes the past on his home planet. If he indulges this metaphor of going back to the past, back to mortality, humanity immediately spins out of control and has nobody left to save them. The bottom line is that we're being instructed, as a society, to embrace genetic enhancement of humanity to escape our emotional wound of being mortal. If we don't make it socially acceptable, then people will hesitate to be the superheroes they're destined to be, and will thereby compromise the future of humanity by hiding from what they truly are in favor of pretending to be like everybody else. What Superman always learns in the end is that he has to be true to who he is. If he runs from being this immortal freak due to fear that society won't accept him as normal, then he can't offer them the love they deserve. So, he always chooses to return to being Superman upon careful consideration. Because otherwise, the world is doomed. The future needs superheroes to save humanity, and also requires society to accept that. Yet, the reason I fight for these things, despite what anybody thinks of me, is that I envision a future where people like Blake's mother, Christina, don't have to show up at their ex-husband's doorstep to learn their child has been butchered and is never coming back. When she says that her life froze in that moment and seemingly never began again, I feel it to the core of my being. We can do better. There was no Superman who came to save Blake Dickus. I think there should be. We put it on screen because we find it in our hearts and minds. There's a reason. It's a projection of our desires. But Blake and China Dickus can no longer fight for that future. Let it be a lesson. We are beautiful creatures who require constant change to survive this world. And I think there's a little bit of Superman within each of us. We all want to save the world in our own way, but don't know how to get there being the person we currently are. Most of us don't know how to fly, or think that we never could, so we don't take the first step off that cliff due to fear. But as with everything, you have to let go. We have been given minds that dictate one idea. If you can dream it, then it's possible. So I ask you, if nothing else, to keep dreaming, even if no one believes. Because like Superman learns, your purpose and your worth have no connection to how others perceive you. Society doesn't get to decide who you are. You do. So no matter what, bring your dreams into reality and light the world with hope. Because if there's any path we can all agree to follow, surely that's the one.